When I was a teenager, Anna Wood died. It was a pretty big deal. When looking back over the 90s, working on this podcast, and wanting to tell the story of being a teenage music fan in Australia during that decade, the Anna Wood moment has always been on the list, from day one. It's been there for years, probably when I first made a list of bands and non-band things that I wanted to talk about. I have wobbled on doing this episode at all many times, partly because this isn't really my story to tell. But like Silverchair, which was a thing that happened to three teenagers from Newcastle but also happened to me, so too was Anna Wood. Anna Wood ended up being something that happened to a generation. I'm very aware that someone died and her family are still around and that there's no way that hurt ever stopped. I can only say that this was big news. It's not something I was supposed to have no view on. If you don't know who Anna Wood was at all, I suggest you have a look. Don't just let this be the only way that you hear this story. This isn't the inside story or the definitive story or any sort of authority. It's just a story. There's another aspect to all this that makes me kind of the wrong person to make this episode, and that's dance music. When I think about this incident, it was very much tied to the dance music scene and how it was tied to drugs, or at least how it was presented to teenage kids like me. It's the reason I never had the word rock in the subtitle. When we talk about the 90s Australian alternative music scene, there's no way it could be about alternative rock only. So in this episode, you will occasionally hear the pain I feel from having splinters in my ass from sitting on so many fences. But I'll lay out what I know and what it all looks like when we look back at it. Welcome to Just Ace, a podcast about the 90s Australian alternative music scene, whatever the hell that is. This week, we look at how dance music and drugs were presented to the mainstream and the sad death of a young girl. This episode deals with a few sensitive and disturbing topics, so keep that in mind, okay? When did I first hear about drugs? I think it has to be through music and related pop culture. Sex and drugs and rock and roll, right? Like learning about sexuality through teenage songs, so too did pop music teach me drugs. But often it was cartoonish. It's like saying Boys to Men's I'll Make Love to You has anything to do with sex. In the early 90s, whether I knew it or not, there was a lot of drugs in the culture. Some artists like Whitney Houston hid their drug addiction and climbed the pop charts. As a kid who bought pop singles, I had no idea about that. There was the heroin chic of models like Kate Moss, who seemed to make drugs out to be a shiny fashion statement. I guess that was true with figures like Johnny Depp as well, whose spaced-out hedonism suggested drugs. I guess. Look, I was just a kid. Then there's that awful 1991 film about the Doors, where drugs played a big out-of-proportion part in their story. And of course, you learn about the so-called 27 Club, and the continued mysterious allure of the young, beautiful, difficult artists who all died at the age of 27, like Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix. As a young music fan, you quickly learned that ODing was something that happened to musicians. It didn't seem like something that happened to, say, cricket players. As grunge came through, what popular music said about drugs changed. Did I know Kurt Cobain was a drug addict? Anthony Kiedis? Trent Reznor? I think so, but I'm not sure. I was too busy sorting those CD singles in alphabetical order. Either way, the pop charts were topped by these dangerous artists who lived sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was part of the appeal. In fact, it's always part of the appeal of music. Musicians live the life that we can only dream. They buy and drive houses and cars that we can't afford. They have the kind of sex that we never have, and they do the kind of drugs that we can never get our hands on. And then, in 1993, River Phoenix died. I loved him in Indiana Jones and that very fun film Sneakers. He wasn't Jimi Hendrix or someone deep in history. He was our generation. He had a drug overdose, heroin and cocaine. He died on the street outside the Viper Room in LA. It was big news. But it's wrong to talk about drugs as all drugs, because heroin is different from pot and different to the one that really seemed to capture the attention in the 90s, ecstasy, also known as MDMA. And it wasn't the grunge types or the rock stars that were taking this one. It was the dance world. So, some history. But someone ought to do a real history of the Australian dance music scene from the 80s and 90s. But I have a feeling it's the old cliche. If you remember it, You probably weren't there. The UK dance scene was bigger and more developed than Australia's in the 80s, as was the drug scene that went with it. The use and reputation of ecstasy, which was a new drug, was more overt in the UK in the 90s. Drugs was just a big part of the dance music scene in the UK and a big part of the story of bands like Primal Scream and Happy Mondays. The story goes that the Manchester club, the Hacienda, the home of the UK dance scene at the time, made no money because everyone took drugs and didn't buy booze. This was music to take drugs to. At least, it was music to take this particular drug to. Music to take drugs to is not a new concept. The Grateful Dead, anyone? Australia, especially in the 80s, was a country that liked guitars. It's a simplification, but the era of pub rock meant that your corner hotel was being filled with rock bands. Even in the inner cities where the music was more adventurous and, dare I say, alternative, it was dominated by guys, girls, guitars. But there were people who didn't want to be in that rock scene or wanted more than that rock scene. So under that underground rock scene, an alternative dance scene emerged in Australia. It was tied to the English scene and English backpackers who came to Australia and wanted to go to the same raves they went to back home. But in England, you were doing it in cold warehouses. In Australia, you can have them outdoors, in the bush, on the beach, and under the sunshine. Sure, you could go to the nearby Spanish island of Ibiza, but if you really wanted to escape, you came to Australia. Raves were usually underground like they were in the UK, and they would go on all night. In Australia, the early raves were exclusive affairs where you needed to know someone to get a ticket. It fueled the club scene around King's Cross in Sydney, but there were interesting scenes everywhere. Every city could have a warehouse rave. Places near the water could have beach parties. Even regional areas would have what was known as bush doofs. People got together, took drugs, and listened to dance music all night long. In Sydney, with its strong gay and lesbian scene, raves and gay culture got mixed together as well. The music was mostly the UK stuff at the start. Groundbreaking underground DJs like Paul Oakenfold or Danny Rampling, whose names would later become more well known. A lot of the music was coming into Australia as imports, stocked by dance store specialists like Central Station Records. They were sought after and rare. After a while, as always, a local version developed. In Sydney, the local scene was based around Volition Records, founded by Andrew Penhallow. More than a label, they helped to put on dance nights and grew the scene as a whole. Volition's big acts included Seven Heads, Boxcar, and Itchy and Scratchy. That last one, Itchy and Scratchy, the name was spelt with capital letter E's at the end of each word, and let me spell it out for the people at the back. It was a reference to ecstasy. Like its moodier cousin alternative rock, a small industry rose to support this alternative dance scene. They had their own street press, like Sydney's 3D World, which started in 1989. There were specialist dance music shows, including The Rhythm Method and The Groove Train on Double J. In 1995, Triple J launched Mix Up, probably the most important dance music show in Australian music history. The Big Day Out launched The Boiler Room in 1994. It was curated by the Volition team, and it was a tent that was the home of dance music for that festival. But The Boiler Room was indicative of where dance music was, because dance music always seemed to run in parallel to rock music. It was put in its own tent, cornered off from the rock kids. Yes, there were people who wandered into that tent, but there were thousands that never did. Dance music wasn't on the main stages in the early to mid-90s. As bands like Silverchair and UMI topped the charts, Australian dance music remained underground. The mainstream had no idea what was going on in the Australian dance scene, but they would soon find out. There's a few reasons why this episode comes up in 1995 in our timeline. Anna Wood died in October 1995. But there's a couple of other reasons. One was the release of quite a few songs about drugs. For some reason, if you look at the Hottest 100 of 1995, drugs was on the mind. Ammonia's big hit single Drugs was released. It wasn't the deepest discussion about drugs, and drugs could have really been any word at all. It could have been bugs. But drugs sounded cool and dangerous. Seven Heads' Heart of the Party is arguably about drugs. Technoheads' I Wanna Be a Hippie and Dash Rip Rock's Let's Go Smoke Some Pot are less arguably about drugs and more actually about drugs. Mindless Drug Hoover's The Reefer Song came in at number 12 in the Hottest 100 of 1995. And that song was a little acoustic joke by an amateur British musician named Matt Hayden. It was a hidden track on a UK techno compilation. Triple J would often play strange things, and this was certainly one. The naughtiness of that song helped to get it in the charts. The song wasn't even remotely a hit in the UK or anywhere else. It was the first song that this guy ever made. Here's Mindless Drug Hoover with the 1995 song, The Reefer Song.
One sunny day I was riding my bike and smoking a joint, 'cause that's what I like. A policeman stopped me and began to stare and said, "Hey, sonny, what you smoking there?" I said, "It's a reefer, do you want some, policeman? It's a reefer, do you want a blast? It's a reefer, do you want some, policeman? Or would you prefer me to shove it up your ass?" Well, he put me in.
Then there's Everclear's Heroin Girl, which came in at number 6 in the list. Pulp's Common People was at 38, and although that's not a drug song, the album it's from featured a single called Sorted for Ease and Whiz. The clip of them performing that song at Glastonbury in 1995 was everywhere, and it was made into the official film clip for Sorted for Ease and Whiz. All those songs were very different and about different drugs, but that's a lot. And that's not all. There was one other important drug song on the list. It came in at number 9 in the Hottest 100 of 1995. It was called He'll Never Be an Old Man River, and it was by the band TISM. TISM were a band who ate taboo topics for lunch. They pushed the barrier of what is or isn't offensive. They released He'll Never Be an Old Man River right in the middle of the decade when the culture was changing. Weird and wonderful stuff was being allowed on the radio for some reason. The song is about River Phoenix, and the hook about being on the drug that killed him is repeated over an aggressive dance beat. People were offended back in the day. I've played this song to friends who have never heard it before, and they are offended now. I've heard people say that this is one of the worst pieces of music they've ever heard. Here's TISM with He'll Never Be an Old Man River.
I'm on the drug, I'm on the drug, I'm on the drug that killed River Phoenix. I'm on the drug, I'm on the drug, I'm on the drug that killed River Phoenix.
The band argues that the song had nothing really to do with River Phoenix, but, you know, it kind of did. But it was also about celebrity culture and drug culture. It's about people who idolize celebrity drug addicts. But I also grant that TISM made a song and not a lecture, and people misunderstanding TISM is at the heart of what TISM do. It was also important that it was a dance track. People were happily taking drugs to this song in clubs. I know Ammonia's Drugs was three-chord silliness, but TISM was making fun of a bigger issue that few people were actually talking about. 1995 was also a breakthrough year for dance music. In January of 1995, Central Station Records, which was a store but also a label, released a couple of singles they licensed from overseas. The first was Here's Johnny by Hocus Pocus, a Dutch dance duo. They also released a cover of Total Eclipse of the Heart, a dance version featuring Nicki French. Neither song got commercial airplay, but had featured in clubs and the odd community radio dance show and the network that had sprung up in Australia to support independent dance. Central Station was distributed by Shock, an indie distributor. No mainstream exposure, no major record company. By April 1995, Here's Johnny by Hocus Pocus was the number one single in Australia. Australia was the only country where the song charted. Behind it at number 2 is Total Eclipse of the Heart. In the same week, Silverchair's Frog Stomp came out and got to number 1 in the albums. And that was a major label album in every sense, really. Dance music was the indie stuff. Just saying. Here's Johnny by Hocus Pocus.
Here's Johnny! Thank you.
drum go like...
1995 was the year of the very first ARIA Award for Best Dance Release. It's an important step towards mainstream acceptance. It was won by Itchy and Scratchy, one of those volition acts, with their track Sweetness and Light. It came in at number 21 in the Hottest 100 of 1995 and charted in the regular charts at number 65. The track is hugely influential, and dance website In The Mix later called it the greatest Australian dance track of all time. So here's Itchy and Scratchy with Sweetness and Light. The 1995 ARIA Awards ceremony came around and Itchy and Scratchy were presented with their award. The duo, who are Paul Mac and Andy Ranson, took to the stage. And then Paul Mac took to the mic to do his thank yous. And he thanked Sydney's ecstasy dealers on national
and
TV.
And the winner is... Let's
see who's in there.
Itchy and Scratchy, Sweetness and Light.
Cheers. Wow, total spin out. This track was made at home in a bedroom, so anybody can do it. So, and all the DJs who play it, all the public radio stations, all the ravers, all the everybody, thank you very much. Thanks
to How did people not know Elton John was gay? How did people get outraged when they found out Paul McCartney smoked pot? I guess it wasn't that people didn't know, but more they didn't think about it. In 1995, the Australian dance music scene was not something a lot of people thought about. Michael Jackson was one of the biggest stars in the world at the time, and TISM's He'll Never Be an Old Man River ends with a prediction that he will be the next celebrity drug burnout. And if you asked me at the time, I had no idea that Michael Jackson was like that. He was just the dude from that Black or White song with that cool morphing film clip. We just didn't think about it. And then Paul Mac had to go and point it out to everyone in Australia. It was that terrible Doors film, Kurt Cobain, River Phoenix, the ammonia song Drugs. This was all in the air, but it hadn't come together. It was all building up. The 1995 ARIA Awards, where ecstasy dealers were thanked, was held on the 20th of October, 1995. The very next night, a 15-year-old girl named Anna Wood went to a rave at the Phoenician Club in Sydney. So yeah, disclaimer on this. It's sad and sensitive stuff. Careful listening with kids. I'm only giving a summary. There's a few different tellings of this story. Read more than one before you make up your mind about anything, as I'm sure you do as you listen to this podcast because you're a smart person who's never been tricked into cheap outrage by a clickbait headline. Okay. Anna Wood was a 15-year-old girl. She was born in 1980, just like me. She was 5 months older than me. She would have been in my year at school. I knew people who kind of knew her. 15 is too young to go to a rave, but Anna, who lived in the affluent, fairly white suburb of Belrose, and some friends snuck out of their homes and went to one. They told their parents they were having a sleepover. She went to a rave called Apache at the Phoenician Club in Sydney. 3 years earlier, Nirvana played their big Sydney show there. The month before, Jeff Buckley played there. The Phoenician had rock shows, but they had their share of dance shows too. It wasn't an illegal underground warehouse thing where you bought tickets from someone in the know. This was about as mainstream as it gets, with all the permits in place. In the early 90s, police had started to target these raves, including ones held at the Phoenician Club. Not fiercely, but they would raid the weekend dance parties and leave the rock bands alone. Places like the Phoenician would struggle to keep up with changing rules about capacity and safety imposed on them. But they kept on. Anna and some friends, one of whom was 19, bought some drugs from someone they knew before going to the rave. That drug was ecstasy. They took the pills before they entered the club. At around 4 or 5 a.m. the next morning, with the rave still going on, friends witnessed that Anna was feeling sick and was running to the toilets and vomiting. So they went back to one of their friends' homes and Anna was put to bed. She ultimately fell unconscious. Her parents were told about her condition at 10 a.m. and she was taken to Royal North Shore Hospital in St. Leonard's. She never regained consciousness and died on the 24th of October, 2 days later. I would argue that, rightly or wrongly, Australian media were waiting for this. Like I said, it was building up, and it became news straight away. Anna Wood wasn't a junkie. She wasn't a weird new age dance hippie. She wasn't in a band who displayed heroin chic. She was achingly normal. She came from a middle class suburb. The photos of Anna, which were immediately all over the news, showed her smiling in her school uniform and being a kid. There had been zero deaths in Australia up to that point from ecstasy, and the first one just had to be her 15-year-old girl, didn't it? Media outrage back then isn't like media outrage now. It was in one direction, and people couldn't comment and add to the argument on social media. You were told what to be outraged about, and that was that. The photo of a smiling Anna Wood in her school uniform was everywhere. It was on the front page of newspapers the next day. It was the lead story on the news. The Daily Telegraph, the largest Sydney paper at the time with 1.3 million readers, ran the headline, Anna's Deadly Party. Inside the paper was something more extreme. There was a double page spread that supposedly drew the curtain down on the drug scene. This is just one day later. Here are the points that it hits. They showed posters for dance parties with arrows showing how the letter E was really big as a code for ecstasy. It's a secret code. A subheadline explains how it was tied to the gay club scene in a nice bone to throw to homophobic mainstream Australia. Remember, at this time in Australian history, homosexuality was still illegal in parts of the country. There was a lot about Anna herself. Photos of her school, interviews with her principal, how she was going to go into fashion. This was key. She wasn't an inner city junkie, she was a nice, normal Australian girl, whatever the hell that means. There was, of course, painting the picture of the dance and drug scene and how easy it was to get drugs. The idea they were showing you was that drugs were now leaving the seedy nightclubs and getting into our schoolyards. I guess when a young girl dies, it's easy and probably right to ask, how did this happen and who is to blame? But Anna Wood didn't simply take an ecstasy pill and die. She died from how her body reacted to the pill. Her friends took the same pills and didn't react the same way. The news immediately speculated that the ecstasy was laced with something more dangerous like heroin. There was no proof of that this early in the story, but they ran it anyway. MDMA was found in Anna Wood's system, but nothing else. The rumours that it was laced was just rumours. Anna's death was ultimately ruled to be water intoxication. As crazy as it sounds, you can drink too much water. Drinking massive amounts of water in a short time dilutes your body. The delicate mix of how your body works gets literally watered down. Cells absorb too much excess water and start to swell, starting with the cells in the brain. The general consensus was that the MDMA made her extremely thirsty and she drank too much. But the media couldn't blame water. In the immediate aftermath of Anna Wood's death, the targets were the dance music scene as a whole and the Phoenician Club in particular. There were calls for the Phoenician to be closed down. New restrictions were placed on the venue that saw its capacity pretty much halved. Their reputation trashed and Bleeding Money, the place where Nirvana played in Sydney, shut down in 1998, a couple of years later. The fact that Anna and her friends bought the drugs outside the venue and took them before they ever stepped inside didn't matter. Next, it was the rave scene as a whole. TV news stories would show that photo of Anna and remind you that she died. Then, cut to footage of dark nightclubs with people off their faces as loud music blared, possibly sourced by hidden cameras. In the mainstream press, dance music was described with terms like ear-splitting and skull-crushing. It was the picture of a debauched night that normal people should be shocked by. But that said, ecstasy was tied to this dance scene. There's no doubt about it. Their effect, hours of euphoric highs, worked with raves. You don't take E and listen to Nick Cave be sad about God at a piano. So someone had to pay, and there were going to have to be changes. A six-month trial of new liquor laws passed in 1996 and quickly spread outside Sydney to regional Australia and other states. It was the dance nights of clubs that were targeted, or venues that held dance nights exclusively. People who had put on illegal dance parties for teenagers that worked closely with police and local councils and community groups, well, they just shut down. These were safe, planned, alcohol-free events for under 18s and held at reasonable times. They were probably no different from a school formal if they had played dancey music, but they had to go. Less than a year after she died, there was a book about Anna Wood, written by Bronwyn Donaghy. Of course, the photo of her in her school uniform is on the cover, and every edition since. It is still in print. In some states, it was added to the English curriculum. It was read together in classes. There were copies at libraries for kids to take. It was published before the coroner's report. It was written with a purpose. It's not remotely pretending to be unbiased or balanced. It was written to push a point, and it was pushed down our throats. And this is where I come into the story, I guess. I had a copy of this book. I have no idea how. I was hanging out at a lot of youth places after school, and I think it was given to me there. There was a big, concerted zero-tolerance campaign with drugs, and I was the target. The Wood family became prominent spokespeople for zero tolerance. They were invited to talk about their daughter's story all over the world, and they went. The book about their daughter has been released in many countries around the world and translated into different languages. The media continued to run Anna's story. Her funeral was covered by all the news, who were given access to take photos and do interviews. There was an Anna Wood Drug and Alcohol Education Project run by the Australian Medical Association, also known as the AMA. It was endorsed by her family. Her death, of course, had nothing to do with alcohol, but they printed badges with Anna Wood's face with the slogan Just Say No. Just Say No, of course, was the slogan of the American War on Drugs. There was plenty of backlash too. Doctors, many of them also members of the AMA, argued that Anna Wood's death actually showed the need for education, or what is called harm reduction. They tried to invite the Wood parents into conversation, but they went down the zero tolerance path. But as several people pointed out, if those young girls had more information about ecstasy and hadn't panicked and feared they would get into major trouble, maybe they would have taken their friend to the hospital straight away instead of taking her back to her friend's home. The dance music scene, if anything, united. They happily did interviews with mainstream news and engaged smartly with people who wanted to attack them. There's a hilarious exchange in a 1996 episode of 60 Minutes that looked at dance raves. The presenter, Tracy Curry, asks DJ Pee-wee Ferris about how the music is monotonous. His response is, so is classical music.
The stars of the rave scene are the DJs. And the best by far is Pee-wee Ferris. Pee-wee does a lot more than spin discs. He creates his own music in this studio. Styles with weird names a world away from rock and roll.
Okay, maybe I'm not listening. But it does seem very monotonous.
A lot of people say that about classical, where they don't understand it.
And then there's Nasenbluten. They were a Newcastle electronic music group, and a really intense hardcore one at that. They held parties for friends and made music on home computers, and they circulated tapes that managed to get their music released in underground circles in America. Their name is the German word for nosebleed. It's worth saying that Nasenbluten were a very underground band who used offensiveness as one of their ways to express themselves. In 1996, they released a single called Show Us Your Tits. But really, it should have been called Fuck Anna Wood, as that's what is said in the song, and what everyone calls the song. It was a deliberately tasteless cry of anger, reacting against a moral panic. It used clips from news stories about Anna Wood in the song. They never sold it, but they made 50 copies and gave them to friends. The cover was that same photo of a smiling Anna Wood with the words, I'm having the best night of my life, as opposed to Just Say No. A copy of the single goes for $2,000 on Discogs. If you have one, please let me know. So yeah, possibly the most offensive song you'll hear today. Here's Nasenbluten with Show Us Your Tits.
The tragic death of 15-year-old Sydney schoolgirl Anna Woods just a few months ago highlighted what, for many, has become a problem of almost epidemic proportions.
Anna Wood.
Wood.
But the moral panic was on. It was sadly predictable. Who took the blame was not ecstasy, but every drug and alcohol too. It was young people who were dumb and can't be trusted, who were dangerous themselves and surrounded by danger. And this new dance music, which sounds awful and should be stopped. In fact, it was so predictable that it all happened again on the other side of the world. Anna Wood died on the 24th of October 1995. And just over 3 weeks later, in the UK, they turned off the life support system for an 18-year-old girl named Leah Betts. Leah Betts had taken ecstasy at home with her friends and then drank 7 litres of water in an hour and a half. She died of water intoxication, same as Anna Wood. The UK media reacted much the same as the Australian media. Leah Betts was a middle-class young girl and, like Anna Wood, challenged what the great unwashed thought of as a drug taker. The Betts family actually allowed a photo of a comatose Leah Betts in her hospital bed to be circulated to the press as a warning about drugs. The Betts family became the face of anti-drug campaigning in the UK. It was, typically, tied to raves, even though Leah Betts was nowhere near one. The Betts family appeared at the press conference of a new bill that allowed police to shut down venues if they found drugs. And like Wood, there was a book about Leah Betts which told her life story. Endless articles about ecstasy and dance culture filled the British press. Statements like, "There is only one truth about ecstasy, it kills." Or, "Ecstasy is one of the biggest threats to young people." Or, "Ecstasy users often have violent and unpredictable results." And, "If it can happen to the Betts family, it can happen to any family." Newspapers reported that several hundred were dying from MDMA-related deaths every year. The truth was less than 10, often far less than 10. Leah Betts' face was used in a poster campaign against drugs, just like Anna Wood's face was used as the most powerful marketing tool for the Australian anti-drug campaign. The poster featured a photo of Betts with the big word saying "sorted," that British slang for having drugs. You know, like that Pulp song, "sorted for ease and whiz." The posters were used in massive billboards in over 1,000 UK towns and cities. It was later revealed that tobacco companies and energy drink companies had helped pay for some of the posters. At the same time, these companies were running campaigns for energy drinks to be an alternative to ecstasy. And in the UK, like in Australia, the backlash was varied. There was a reactive poster campaign with the word "distorted" and the same design and photo of Leah Betts. It pointed out that you had as much risk of dying from ecstasy as you did from eating a bay leaf. It was funded by the band Chumbawamba, years before their hit Tub Thumping. It made that band the drug story for a while, and it gave people a new target. Tabloids called parents of people who died and played them the music of Chumbawamba. But by then, it was too late. Laws passed and the rave scene as it was known was legislated out and killed by policies. Both the UK and Australia saw the passing of restrictive laws that clamped down on the way dance music venues worked. But some of them were underground, unregulated and probably dangerous. The dance scene, which was once only available to people who knew how to get tickets, had become too big. They couldn't coast on the excuse of just giving a small amount of people a good time. It was painful, but what ultimately happened was the dance scene got their act together. Venues still held dance parties for teenagers after figuring out how to do it under new rules, and that included that they had to be under 18s only. But those new regulations meant that many venues worked out how to open on an afternoon and not serve drinks, and their staff learned how to deal with teenagers. It led to those venues opening up for rock and punk shows, and it started a golden age of under 18s gigs in Australia. I confess, I didn't get into dance music until much later. Sometimes you need someone to show you this stuff, and it took me to my 20s to find someone to do that. But by the late 90s, dance music was smashing its way into the mainstream. I couldn't escape it, and neither could you. Massive crossover artists like The Prodigy, Fatboy Slim, Underworld, Moby, and The Chemical Brothers had invaded the pop charts. All these artists played the big day out in those years, and there were many great dance songs in every year's Hottest 100. I was starting to be beat curious as the decade came to a close. The Australian side was exciting too. Volition Records acts also filled Big Day Out's boiler rooms, although Andrew Penelow would put a pause on Volition in 1997. Bands like Sonic Animation would release the super fun Theopolis Thistler, which got to number 18 in the Hottest 100 of 1999. Paul Mac, half of Itchy and Scratchy, who thanks Sydney's ecstasy dealers, became a household name, at least for households in the inner city, and he would form a duo with Silverchair's Daniel Johns in 2003, bringing 90s alternative rock and 90s alternative dance together. But two big Australian dance hits that ended the decade had its roots in the 80s underground scene. They showed how that scene could dust itself off and become bigger than ever. The first one, also in 1999, is Madison Avenue's Don't Call Me Baby. It was a big, slick commercial hit. Madison Avenue were a duo that was Shane Coates, who co-produced and sang, along with Andy Van, who co-founded the Australian 80s dance label Vicious Vinyl. Van in particular had learnt his craft from the Australian 80s indie dance scene. The song, released on Vicious Vinyl, made number 22 in the Hottest 100 of 1999 and peaked at number 2 in the normal charts and was the highest selling Australian single of 1999. Here's Madison Avenue with Don't Call Me Baby. But the second one I like better. It came out a year earlier in 1998. Josh Abrahams was also from the indie scene and was a member of the pioneering dance group The Future Sound of Melbourne. He left them and did soundtrack work, including producing Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen, a minor hit in the 90s that Baz Luhrmann was involved in. But that's not the song. Abrahams knew a young actress named Amiel and asked her to sing on some tracks that he was producing. The first single he released with her vocals was called Addicted to Bass. Released through an imprint on Shock Records, it hit number 15 in the Australian charts, number 16 in the Hottest 100 of 1998, and was on dance charts all around the world. And let's face it, the title is an interesting pun about addiction and dance music. Here's Josh Abrahams and Amiel with Addicted to Bass.
I got two pale hands up against the window pane. I'm shaking with the heat of my need again. Starts in my feet, reverbs up to my brain. There's nothing I can do to revert the gain. I'm looking down to the street below. There's nothing in the way they move to show. They too know what I know. They too hunger for the beast below. About my weakness, I'm totally addicted to bass. Wow, wow.
I've read a lot about the 80s rave scene in Sydney and Melbourne, and it sounded like fun, but it also sounded like it couldn't last forever. Someone was going to work out how to make it corporate and make a safer version to sell to the masses. Anna Wood's death accelerated that. But that 80s scene did seem fantastic, and I understand that people will always say there was something special about the scene they grew up with. Some people might actually make a podcast about the scene they grew up in. But scenes don't last forever, and the rave scene changed. And it changed into having even bigger dance music festivals like Parklife, which started in 2000 and promoted itself as an intelligent dance festival. It changed to having global superstar DJs. It changed to that weird-looking David Guetta guy as being super famous and now treated like a rock star. But at those dance festivals, in Australia, we are having the zero-tolerance versus harm reduction debate again, in the form of pill testing. I absolutely am not an expert on this, but have a look at the issues on both sides. It's worth noting that Anna Wood's father, Tony, has been speaking on the news on the zero-tolerance side. This was as recently as 2020. I feel sad for Anna Wood and her family, and Leah Betts and her family. I really do. I see Tony Wood on TV or on radio, and all I can think is, I get it. Go be you. I've seen people say he's abusing his position and story. All I can say is that if what happened to him happened to me, I would punch a hole in the fucking world. I have less sympathy for the advocacy groups who took grieving parents and moulded them to suit their issues. But the debate on drugs rages on, and I will take that splinter out of my ass for 1 minute to say this. I understand the appeal of zero tolerance. I mean, on the surface, it's like saying to someone, can you not? It should be so simple, but it's not. We can't stop it, and scare tactics only go so far. We've tried it. Banning a song is one of the very few guaranteed ways to have a hit. Banning drugs only serves to promote it. But light beats the dark. Education, understanding, and demystifying are all at least part of the solution. For addiction, you can only fight it with education and support. And you can't eliminate drugs, not physically, and you can't destroy the centuries of art and culture that talks about drugs. Drugs are not a new thing. You are lucky because I worked on a whole section going back to before the blues about musicians and drugs. You were spared an 8-minute episode intro about jazz. But drugs were always here and aren't going anywhere. But what can change is how we talk about it. We can make our kids super smart. They need to know how to take care of each other. They need to know when someone is in trouble. They need to know where to find information if they want it. They need to know what to do if something goes wrong, like we ask them to do when they start driving. And they need to do it with no fear in their hearts. This episode is all over the shop in terms of sources. There's a lot written about the Australian dance scene in the 80s and 90s, but really I would just be merging other people's work. I'll link to articles in the show notes, but a proper book, an oral history, is in order. I bet poor Mac has already started work on it. On the website, I'll have a playlist of every Australian dance track that made it to the Hottest 100 in the 90s. Remember Single Gun Theory? There's some good stuff on there. And the Anna Wood stuff. There's that book about her. It is still in print, and there's plenty of articles and a few academic studies on what happened. There's quite a few news stories online as well. This would make a good documentary, right? But it would probably side too much on one side or the other. I hope what you got out of this at least is a good story about two sides and lots of drama from the 90s. Let's end with some music. And it's the track I mentioned earlier, Sonic Animation's Theophilus Thistler. They were a Melbourne dance group that signed to the festival-distributed label Global Recordings. They were inspired by rave music and bands like Underworld. They had a couple of mascots that looked like Teletubbies called Techo Tubbies. One of them was named Theophilus Thistler, after a famous tongue twister. The song comes from their breakthrough 1999 album Orchard for the Afterworld. It got to number 18 in the Hottest 100 of 1999. Here's Theophilus Thistler, open parentheses, An Exercise in Vowels, close parentheses, by Sonic Animation. It still sounds incredible. Listening and welcome to The End Bit. This is where I talk about ways that you can support the podcast. Look, the new thing this year is the book. Just Ace is now a book. It's the first 2 seasons of the podcast that I've adapted to work as a book. There's no need to ever know there was a podcast. Basically, all the research and stories that I've written are back and in a new form. It's over 400 pages of nerdy deep dives into the 90s Australian music scene, and it also features artwork by me. You can get it on your local Amazon store, including Amazon Australia, where there's a link in the description. But if you're not in Australia and you want to get it in the UK or the US or Japan, you can just use your local Amazon store. And if you do buy it, feel free to leave me a 5-star review on Amazon as well. Every little bit helps. The book's been out now for a few weeks and it got to number 1 on the Amazon music history charts, which is amazing. And I know a few of you have been sharing pictures of the book when it's been delivered to your house on socials, which is amazing. It's amazing that people I'm not related to have a copy. There's also the usual ways of supporting me, which I'll talk about in upcoming episodes, like the Patreon or the tipping service Buy Me a Coffee or buying some merch. There's also the no-cost ways of supporting me, like leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, sharing links to social media, following me on socials, or simply telling a friend. All the links you need, plus the website and how to connect with me, are in the description. Okay, next week, we are on to 1995 and a band that really shouldn't have their history told.
Hello, music lovers. My name's Nathan Jolly. I'm the host of Listen Carefully, a weekly podcast where every Saturday morning I talk to a different musician about their lives in and around music.
We'll have all contemporary music fans singing Yay Ha.
Search for Listen Carefully with Nathan Jolly wherever you listen to podcasts.